Thanks, Derek. I just want to acknowledge the collaborators on this project. Jerry Taylor at the zoo was basically the lead on the research portion of the project. Scott Brown, economist in our econ department, is actually going to be completing the economic impacts resulting from outcomes from this project. Mike Smith was more or less involved with a lot of the curriculum development related to the project. And then Bob Schnabel, obviously, in Jerry's group, Scott Polk in our vet school, Jared Decker in our genomics group, Dwayne Daly in our information group, and then myself at Mizzou, Allison Benedum at UC Davis is involved very extensively with the extension outreach portion of it. And then Megan has really been the lead relative to a lot of the educational modules that have been developed in support of this project. And she's going to talk a little bit about that as we go through it. And then Brian Kinghorn and Mike McNeil have collaborated extensively with Allison in terms of some of the extension-related outcomes, which we'll touch on. So the long-term goal of this project is really to improve reproductive performance of cattle. And this project at the outset was more or less specific to Angus. And I think all of us are pretty well aware of the importance of reproductive efficiency in cowherds across the country. And the team that was put together to really work collaboratively on this project, I think working together not only in terms of the research portion as well as the extension aspects in addition to the educational portions of the project, I think were significant relative to the producers that we collaborated with relative to sample collection as well as some of the CSOC input that we received from American Angus. So I think all of us are well aware of the fact that reproduction is critical relative to long-term reproductive efficiency, and in particular, the significance that early conception is really one of the biggest drivers relative to reproductive management in a herd. And when we submitted this grant, at the time it was submitted actually in 2012 and awarded, the estimate was that the Angus breed accounted for roughly 70% of the genetics in the U.S. Cow herd. And at that time, those estimates were expected to actually increase. One of the situations specific to this project, one of the major considerations relative to that was that Angus in particular has very aggressively used artificial insemination within and across the breed, which more or less has resulted in a reduction in the diversity due in large part to the narrowing of the genetic base. And Megan will kind of lead you through some of the considerations related to that as we move through this. So Jerry, when we put this project together, proposal together, basically what he did was he looked at the mean inbreeding coefficients by birth year for a number of Angus animals. And basically what you can see here is that, and part of this goes back to the point that I made on the previous slide, is that because of the extensive use of artificial insemination in the Angus breed, there has been more or less an increase in more or less the inbreeding within that breed in particular. If you look at what's occurred relative to the genetic improvement within the breed, and in this case, what he looked at was EBVs for a yearling weight of a number of registered Angus bulls, and looking here in particular at yearling weight changes, basically you can see that the improvement that was made at a rate of about 5 pounds per year over a 50-year period. This, on the other hand, is what's been troubling. This is really illustrating the decline in fertility that we've seen in the Angus population. And what you can see here is over the last 25 years, there's been about a accumulation of inbreeding more or less has led to an increase in homozygosity of alleles that reduce fitness. And these can be problems relative not only to deleterious genes that we've seen pop up in terms of congenital anomalies, but also with regard to embryonic and early developmental alleles. So basically, when we consider this in total, presumably calves that are homozygous for loss of functional allele may either abort, be born dead, or die soon after birth, or actually in many cases we don't even know if those cows actually conceive. So the project goals really are multifold relative to this project in general. In general, the gains that we've seen in the Angus breed relative to production traits, we haven't really seen those same traits occur relative to fertility-related traits. Obviously, going back to the point that I made initially, it's no secret as to how important reproduction and reproductive traits are in general. And at the same time, I think we need to understand that there's several ways in which to increase fertility, and that is to maximize the number of females conceived early in the breeding season, and at the same time, maximize or maintain pregnancies that are achieved. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. So I'm going to turn it over to Megan now, and she's going to talk to you a little bit about the genetic implications related.
Okay, so we're going to start with a little bit of review of basic genetics here. So I'll try to get at sort of this question of how does this project impact fertility and how do these alleles that are floating around in the population, how can those impact fertility? So if we start with thinking about where we actually locate these things, we locate them in the DNA. Okay, we've talked a lot about DNA at this meeting. But the idea behind this is that DNA is where we store all the information, and typically we think of that as storing them in genes, right? So the genes store the information that we need to actually make proteins, and proteins are what go out and actually do stuff, okay? So proteins are what are our hormones, or enzymes, and things like that that actually serve a functional purpose within the biology of that animal. So we have a couple of molecules that are involved in this, but I sort of like to think about it like this. I like to cook, so I think of the DNA as like an internet server. Okay, maybe it tells me a bunch of recipes for something I might want to make. And so that's where all that information is stored. And then our intermediate molecule is our messenger molecule, so it's kind of like printing that recipe off. Okay, so we call up the information from the DNA, then we print it off, and then we can actually take it somewhere and we can do something with it. We can make something with it. And that's basically how this works. So the DNA is essentially the information, the basis upon which we make these molecules that need to do important things within the body. So if everything goes right, we have our gene up here and it's got these different regions, and it's not important to know what those regions are for the purposes of this. But let's just say those colored blocks are my instructions for making those cookies or whatever I'm going to make. So that basically tells us how to put that protein together, what little pieces we need to string together to make that functional protein, and then that final protein is going to have some sort of shape and job to go and do. So a protein might interact with some target on a cell, okay, to go do something inside the cell, or it may interact with the DNA directly to have some kind of function. Okay, so in the purposes of this discussion, it's not important other than that those proteins and their shape is important because they go out and do things in the cell. So, when everything goes right, everything's hunky-dory, so what about when things go wrong? Okay? So when things go wrong, let's say we maybe have deletion. Okay? We delete one of those parts of my gene that actually had some information in it that I needed to make that protein. Okay? So in that case, we might lose part of the end of our protein, and maybe that changes its shape a little bit. Okay? So maybe by changing the shape of that protein, it can no longer interact with what it was supposed to interact with, and it's not going to be able to do the job that it was designed to do. And so that can be a problem, and that can manifest itself in a variety of different ways. And of course, the way that we're interested in for this project is when we have cows come up open, because those embryos can't survive without whatever protein that was. So that brings us to sort of thinking about broken genes. So if we break genes by deleting them or changing the sequence of the protein or something like that, that can be a major problem. And sometimes the animal can live, right, but we might see different effects on the phenotype. Okay, so think about maybe something like fawn calf. Okay, calf lives, right, but it has some different phenotypic effects. Okay, but if we have a gene that is essential for life and it breaks in such a way that that protein can no longer function, that's when we have these issues with lethals. Okay, because that if it's a gene that's essential for life, the animal can't live without it. So we have to have a functional version of that protein. So I sort of think about it like cups of coffee, right? Because every animal is going to have two chances to get a functional copy of that gene. One copy comes from mom, one copy comes from dad. So we've got two chances to get a protein or get sequence in that DNA that'll let us make a protein that works. Okay? So I sort of think about it like coffee in the morning. I'm not a coffee drinker, but for people who are, right, two cups of coffee is better than one cup of coffee, probably. But we're going to survive if we at least have one cup of coffee in the morning, right? However, if somebody takes all of our coffee away, it's a bad day, right? So it's the same sort of idea here. And so this is what's called a karyotype, but it's essentially just all the chromosomes. Right? So the only point I want to make here is like for chromosome 1 up there, you see two of them, right? One comes from mom, one comes from dad. So we have two chances to get a gene that we need to live. So each parent is contributing an allele to that progeny, right? One from mom, one from dad. And we've heard this terminology all day, but just for a quick review, if we get the same allele from mom and dad, we're going to be homozygous. And if we get a different one from mom than we get from dad, we're heterozygous, okay? And so when we're talking about things that are lethal or sort of deleterious mutations, we're often talking about these homozygous recessive, so the two little letters. So when all goes well, we have our bull, we have our cow. Let's say the bull's a big A, big A. The cow's a big A, big A. Those chromosomes are going to get selected in the production of gametes. They come together in the calf. In this case, we only had big A normal alleles to provide, right? So that calf's going to get two copies of normal allele. He's going to be perfectly fine. So we might have carriers, right? So let's say the bull is a carrier of something. Cow's not a carrier, right? Homozygous normal. Big A, big A. Okay, so in this case, let's say the bull does pass on that allele. Cow didn't have it to begin with, so she can't pass on. But those alleles come together in the progeny, and we get a calf that's a carrier as well. But that calf's alive, right? He's okay. Now, when we have two carriers, now's when we need to be thinking about what can happen. So 25% of the time, the bull and the cow are going to pass on that normal allele. We don't have anything to worry about. 50% of the time, either the bull or the cow will pass on that little A allele that we're concerned about, right? But as long as they don't both pass it on, we can get a live calf. But 25% of the time, we pass on that little A allele from both the bull and the cow, and it comes together, and in this case, it would be lethal, okay? So this is, of course, a curly calf picture, but the idea is these sort of work the same exact way, but we get a different manifestation in terms of the phenotype. All right. So that's sort of an example with sort of the traditional genetic abnormalities that we're probably most familiar with. However, we can also have early embryonic lethals. This is the same concept. They're inherited the same way. The difference is we don't see them, right? So we might see that our cows are open a little bit longer than maybe we think they should be. Or they come back in heat later in the breeding season after we thought they were already bred. Okay? That's how these things are going to manifest themselves. We don't see them sort of on the ground typically, so that's they're a little bit harder to detect. Okay? So this is where genomic technologies can kind of figure some of these things out. And the idea here is that if we break a gene, okay, whenever we need that gene during development, that's when that abortion is going to occur, when that fetus can no longer continue development, and that's when that cow will show up. All right, so if we're talking about an embryonic lethal, we don't ever see that calf on the ground, right? So instead, what we get, if everything's normal, calf genotype is big A or big A little A, we get calf on the ground. We get calf on the ground. So if we look at the opposite scenario, where the calf genotype would have been little A, right? We get an open calf. So the question we can sort of begin to ask ourselves is, what mutations do we see in the genome that we never ever see as homozygous? Okay? And that works because if they're homozygous, normal, or heterozygous, we see a live calf on the ground. If they're homozygous for that broken allele, we don't ever see those animals born alive. Right? So that's how we can begin to look for these things. So sort of the first step in this process for this project was to sequence a large number of moles within the industry. And you can see in this table, hopefully it's kind of small, but a large number of moles that were sequenced. And when you go through that sequence, you go and look for mutations that they have that we never ever see two copies of that mutation inherited together in a live animal. Okay? So if we see those so-called missing homozygotes, that's our alert. There may be something else going on here. So one of the ways to kind of start to narrow these things down when you see them is we can actually try and figure out, do we think this mutation would have a big impact on the structure of that protein or the shape of that protein? Or we can go to other species. There's been lots of work done in like knockout mice and things like that to look at which genes are essential for life. So if we have a mutation in a gene that's essential for life in another species, that gives us a clue that it might very well be that same sort of situation for beef cattle as well. So you can kind of start to narrow these things. So you take those mutations that you discovered, you can build a genotyping chip, and that's exactly what was done for this project. And that product is the GGPF250. And so the loci of this chip were targeted towards not only these candidate mutations that were never seen as homozygous in this project, but also things that were predicted to be functional in terms, and by that I mean predicted to have some kind of impact on protein structure or function when we have changes in those proteins or in that DNA sequence. So once that chip is built, then starts the validation process. So just because it goes on the chip doesn't mean that it's necessarily automatically illegal, right? We want to go through and genotype a really large number of animals on this particular chip to, again, narrow those candidates down. And for this particular project, there were a little over 11,000 animals genotyped specifically for this project. And those were heifers, I believe, largely from, a lot of them were from Show Me Select program. But there were some others in there as well. And those animals had very complete reproductive data, trash scores, and breeding data, and things like that in that population. So there have been, I think, around 20,000 animals at the zoo, at least, that have been genotyped on this chip as well. So some additional animals there. And the idea here is, of those candidates, when we genotype them in a much larger population of animals, do we ever see any of those as homozygous? And so part of that, that's really important because part of this is a function of numbers. So if we have something that's really rare in the population, you need to sort of figure out and survey a lot of different animals to see if to be confident that if a homozygote is missing, that it's missing because it's lethal, and not missing just because it's rare in the population. And so to that end, one of the things that's kind of interesting about this is even when you have a narrowed down list of candidates, those things can be placed on commercialized genotyping assays. And that becomes really important because even with 11,000 animals genotyped and a couple hundred animals sequenced and things like that, you know, when you start thinking about multiplying that over 500,000 animals that have been genotyped, that's when you can really start to have confidence that if a homozygote was missing, we might be able to detect it with that size of sample, even if it is really rare within the population. So because of that, this is by default probably going to be an ongoing process for a really long time, okay? Because as we sequence more animals, we'll probably find some more candidates, okay, in the future, and I'm talking maybe in the next decade or so, right? Anytime we sequence another animal, that's an opportunity to look for more candidates. And some of the old candidates are going to be eliminated as we genotype more and more animals, okay? We'll find some homozygotes. And the ones that are left are those that we can continue to build evidence that there's potential lethal there. So there are a few limitations of this particular approach. The first one is that, of course, you're limited by the number of animals that have been sequenced, because that's where we originally go in and try to look for those candidates. So the more animals you have sequenced, the more candidates you can find, you kind of narrow down to those later processes. The next is that we're looking at variation in genes with this particular project and the F250 chip. Okay? So we used to think that the genome had these genes in it that make these proteins, and then everything else in the genome is just kind of junk that doesn't do anything. Like, we don't really know why it's there, yada yada. Well, in recent years, we've actually figured out that a lot of what's in that genome actually does things like regulate the expression of genes. Okay, so it's not all junk. But in this case, if it wasn't a variation within a gene, it wasn't necessarily included in that assay. Okay? And then it's, of course, dependent on the quality of the genome sequence. And this is actually a really important bullet point on this slide, because we're very functional to have, or very fortunate to have had a complete bovine genome sequence for a long time. And it's enabled a lot of the tools that we have available today. But the bovine genome sequence was recently redone, and it's of much higher quality than it was before. So a lot of things that might have been in the wrong place in the other assembly and things like that, so a lot of those issues have been fixed now, which helps with this entire process. So the next steps. There are currently about 2,200 candidates, okay? Nobody panic and jump up and leave the room. Okay, this number, it's not, the final number is not going to be this high. Okay, it's not going to be nearly that high. So it looks like, if you look at this chart here, and my pointer is kind of fading, but on the left, or the right-hand side of that, your left, I guess, your left side of the bar chart there, those left-hand two columns, those are probably things that were just really rare. So we probably just haven't seen the homozygotes yet. Kind of those next three are ones where maybe we're starting to have enough evidence to think that those might be lethals. A lot of this stuff over here on your left-hand side of the chart, there's a big question as to what's kind of going on with some of those. And at least some of them appear to be clustered in gene families. And so what that means is that the genotyping probes that are on those chips may not be assaying one single place within the genome. So by that I mean that, okay, if we've got a gene up here at locus A and locus B, okay, but they may have very, very similar sequence. Okay, so we might have AAs at one and BBs at the other. But then when we sort of combine that, you're going to show heterozygotes, because that probe can bind to both of those two different locations. And so there's some work to be done to kind of go back through and narrow that list down and eliminate some of these things that may be more related to structure of the genome necessarily than actually being a lethal mutation. So that's in process right now. And the idea is that once that list is narrowed down, hopefully these things will be able to go into commercially available genotyping tests. And sort of the use of this information, I think, needs a little bit of perspective, because it's easy to get sort of wound up about the fact that we're talking about lethals, and that, of course, sounds really, really terrible. I think it does, too. But I think we need to sort of take a step back on some of these things and think about the consequences. So the consequence of some of these things is going to be a function of the frequency of that mutation in the population. Because let's use me, okay? Let's say I'm a carrier of five lethal mutations, and all five of them I world that carries those lethal mutations. Okay? Those are not a big deal, right? You could never ever have any kind of issue if there's only one of them in the entire population. Okay? The only way you could have an issue is if you, let's say that's an AI siren and you use them widely, and now that alleles in more than one animal in the population. Okay? So the frequency of these things is a big deal, because if it's a low frequency in the population, it's not going to be as big of a challenge to manage around those. So here's an example. A couple of bulls here that have an estimated 18 of these broken alleles that might be lethals. Okay? And this is, I think, a fictitious example here. So I'm not saying anybody has 18, okay? So don't freak out. I'm just saying, let's say they have 18. This is a hypothetical. But let's, if you think about the actual impact on fertility, the allele frequency matters. The frequency of those mutations in the population matters. Because those two bulls right there have the same number of lethal alleles, but the actual impact on fertility is vastly different. So on one, the impact is much higher than the other, because one of them has mutations that are more rare in the population, and the other one has mutations that are more common within the population. So all of this stuff needs context. But I think the bottom line is that with this type of information, we can manage around these things and mitigate their impact on fertility. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Dave to talk about some of the downstream applications.
Thanks, Megan. So I think from the physiology standpoint, I think the exciting thing about this project is the fact that we all know that reproduction is, in general, considered to be fairly lowly heritable and responds most highly to management. But in this case, if we can actually successfully identify these carriers and work with that information then to perhaps minimize reproductive failure or reproductive loss, I think that to me is really sort of the upside of it. So what's shown on this slide is these are some of the players that have participated or are participating currently in the project. And I think one of the important aspects of these integrated projects through USDA is the fact that many of them now are required to have an economic component. And Scott Brown in our econ group at Mizzou is more or less a master at working with sector level analysis to really look at the impacts of some of these some of this information and also newer technologies as to how that might translate into the industry in terms of benefits. So he'll be playing a key role once Jerry's group more or less finishes up the genetic analysis and that Megan alluded to. The other thing is that Mike McNeil has been a contributor to this project from the standpoint of developing selection indexes to look at how this improvement in fertility might play into some outcomes downstream as well. The other thing that we're currently working with American Angus Association on is Brian Kinghorn from Australia has been involved with the project more or less from its inception. And the idea here is that Brian's developed a program called MateCell that more or less can take pedigree information in addition to EPDs of individuals to really look at how you might be able to manage around some of these potential carriers to minimize or mitigate or reduce more or less the possibility of ending up with these homozygous individuals. And so what's currently being planned for this fall is to actually bring a group of seed stock producers in addition to some of the regional folks from American Angus, to sit down with Brian and Allison to more or less work through MateCell to really see how they might be able to plan matings using known carriers or potential carriers to really minimize some of those possibilities going down the road. So the other aspect of this that I think is going to be really important, not only to the industry in terms of producers in general, but also on the academic side as far as university curricula and that sort of thing is the work that Megan's done in terms of the curriculum development, the modules that she's developed. And if any of you have not had a chance to actually view these, I hope you'll take that opportunity because they're very comprehensive. You've got three more in the mill right now, right? Yeah, yeah, she's got lots more, she says. But she's done a great job putting these together, and I think if you have a chance to really sit down and work through these modules, I think you'll be pretty impressed with how comprehensive they really are. So I guess I conclude with that. I don't know if there's time for questions, but I know we're kind of pushed for time a bit, but are there any questions? Yeah.
What's the one hand of games that you have? What's the highest frequency of an average for, say, some
of the higher? Boy, I don't know at this point that we know. Based on, you know, we just had a conference call on the project about a week ago, and at this point, I don't think any of us would be comfortable, and you know, especially Jerry Taylor, I don't think he'd be comfortable in saying, you know, there's a particular one or two that we're seeing in terms of highest frequency. So, yeah.
Do you have
any
low frequency or medium frequency or high frequency?
Well, like Megan showed, it's like, what, 2200 potential? Yeah, so, I mean, it's he's going to be working more over the next 6-7 months to really kind of whittle that list down based on some of the points that Megan made. I don't know if you want to add to that.
I mean, I don't want to speculate too much because I haven't seen a lot of numbers on that, but my expectation would be that they would be reasonably rare. Now, that doesn't mean they'd all be at a frequency of 0.5% or 1% or something, but I think they would be relatively low frequency. As a general rule, that may not be universally true.
How is the dairy industry using this technology right now?
So the dairy industry has identified some haplotypes that impact fertility. So as far as I'm aware, they've been genotyping and incorporating that information into their selection decision.
Yeah.
The loss between legs ejected and heart ratio. You spoke about that loss is due to these problems.
That's a good question. And yeah, the question was, do you suspect that the loss in pregnancies that you see between the preg check and parturition are a function of these loss of functional alleles? I think you might suspect that there may be a percentage of those. But I think our hunch in general is that the majority of the losses are early embryonic losses. And I think, you know, just with time, we'll have a better understanding of how that all plays out. But at this point, I think a lot of it goes back to the fact that in many cases, cows conceive, but those pregnancies are not maintained. And so as Megan indicated, a lot of those cows return to heat, and you suspect that it was a failed pregnancy.